Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 20th, 2006. Today's session is entitled High versus Low Context Communication, presented by Jeff Kirsten Greep. Number is KC-J 2006-04. Let's listen in.
You aren't committed just because you came in the door.
I'm trying to visit each one once.
Okay. We're going to talk about something called face saving as part of today's session. Something called face work. That Dennis came in, realized he had chosen the session he didn't want to choose, and then he was seen. So then he had to say, okay, what do I do to make this okay, not just for me, but for everybody else? Instead of saying, well, I was really bored in your session yesterday, and I didn't mean to come to this one. He wasn't bored. But I mean, that would be something you'd scratch your heads at that and say, couldn't you say anything better than that? But he thought about it for a sec, and then came up with a plausible narrative that left both of us looking okay, and then off he went. That's part of how we manage this divide we're going to talk about today. Today's course is about a particular kind of cultural distinction between high and low context cultures. And by the time you leave today, you'll understand that distinction if you don't already. And also have some tools for navigating across boundaries when you come from one kind of culture and you're interacting with somebody who's from another one. That it's a very interesting difference and among the most confusing differences there is. If you were in John Wallace's session in here yesterday afternoon, he was talking about that feeling of he kept dropping his glasses on the fireplace here and saying that we think of our cultural laws as natural laws, like gravity. Works the same everywhere. And the analogy here is when you move from, say, a low-context culture like ours to a high-context culture, you drop your glasses and they float up. It really is disconcerting. It's not what you expect. It's not a natural law. It's an agreement we make. It's a cultural agreement we've made with each other about how things are going to work. It's so deep-seated that it looks like the water to a fish. I mean, that's what we swim in. And so today we're going to kind of color the water, dye the water, whatever it is they do when they're studying water currents and things, so that you can actually see them and then navigate those. Again, this is a course mostly about navigating a ship. It's not about docking the ship anywhere. You're not going to learn about a particular culture, but to learn if you're going to be navigating, if you're the pilot of a ship, you have to know what sorts of things do I need to pay attention to and adjust to, which things can I safely ignore, so you can make good choices. It's not an unlimited menu of things to pay attention to. So today we're focused on just one kind of cultural difference, that of how much context gets involved. Now, to do that, we have to divide into two equal groups. How many of us are there? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 16, 20. So we have two groups of 10. Actually, this will work out perfectly. So maybe we can just do it by size. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. So if we stop right here, Peter, you're in this one. John, you're in this side. If you would just gather as a group, introduce yourselves to each other in an open space here. I'm actually going to use the front of the room for this. I've got a resource to share with you. Can somebody turn out a few more lights for a minute? A few more lights, just so you can read this. Come on in. You'll want to stand up, folks. You'll be moving real quickly. Yeah. This is a scenario you're going to be eventually just grabbing a partner out of the other group and honoring the instructions here on the sheet. You can just pass the whole pack around. They'll give you very specific particular codes. You must either low or high context communication code to discuss a particular scenario. Your partner's going to have the same scenario but a different code. And I'm going to ask you really just stick to the code that you're given on this. And try not to see their instructions.
We all have the same code.
You do all have the same code. I'm telling you the same. Scenario, and you'll be having a conversation with them, and I want you to to what you noticed about
this
the conversation as you had it. You all
this
listening
is,
close to each other.
This is a young lady who can't be seen.
Well, I pretty soon know her name. Amanda.
And this is Bob. I don't know where he's from. But we just started. Apparently,
it's been
are you ready?
I don't know.
Okay, read the scenario so you understand what it's about. And feel free to refer to it during the conversation. You have to have a perfect conversation to do this. Ladies and gentlemen, may I ask, what did you notice about this exercise, both about what happened and about how you felt about what happened?
Rejection.
I hear rejection. AUA person? I don't know your name.
Oh, Sonia.
Sonia. So I heard Bob say rejection. That was your voice, Bob?
Yes.
Word was on. There you are.
There
we
go. I know without my chair, it's hard.
So rejection.
Embarrassment.
Sonia, what did you say?
Oh, I said I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere.
Okay. Stymied.
Frustration.
Okay, frustration. What am I missing? I missed one.
Embarrassed.
Embarrassed. Oh, yeah. Why embarrassed?
Reading what my character should be, I was trying to play that role, and it was awkward to ask for what I wanted. That was a part of...
You were high context?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, and there was actual embarrassment in not being able to do what you wanted to do.
He said, do you want to raise? And I, it was very... That was...
Too direct.
Too direct.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Other feelings or other things you noticed? Either one.
Power.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that?
Being the manager was, it felt great to be the manager, be a busy person, you know, sort of brushing the other person off.
Okay, you felt justified in doing that because you're a busy person? Yeah.
I think even beyond the fact that I was told I was a manager, being told to communicate in this way made me feel more powerful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. So there's something about that particular style of communication.
Conversation, you know. Like,
so you were low context?
I was high, yes.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that because that's actually pretty interesting.
I felt that the other person wasn't listening to what I was saying.
I heard you say that Michelle was a tough boss. Anything else, by which I mean anything else? Teachers sometimes say anything else when they mean shut up or moving on to the next topic. That's not what I mean. I mean anything else?
Uncomfortable.
Are you, Jen?
Yeah.
Uncomfortable. Is that different than embarrassed? And if so, how?
I think it's different. Like, I don't know. I just felt uncomfortable with the situation. Like, I wanted to get out of it. I don't know. It's like very...
Okay. The fight or flight thing was kicking in and flight was winning. You didn't want to go. That's a natural human reaction in situations of newness that we actually have our adrenal gland, you know, gets us ready for whatever, either fight or flight. Sometimes we flush. Sometimes we sweat. Our voice, you know, our knees shake. All the stuff that happens when you give a public speech, that's an understandable physiological reaction. But it doesn't leave us feeling our best and most comfortable with this new person, and they wonder why you're standing in front of them twitching and turning red. You know? Maybe they don't wonder because they're probably doing the same. What else?
I felt amazed that I could actually be quiet
to say that you felt surprisingly flexible? That you noticed that, oh, I've always done it that way, and yet when I'm asked to do it this way, I can do it. Okay. Great. I can make a different agreement. It's not a natural law. Wouldn't it be fun to opt out of gravity, like you could opt out of higher low context culture? Just have a day where you're not going to honor the law of gravity? Mm-hmm. Today, I'm just going to float. There are alternative theories to gravity, by the way, one of which is that the Earth just sucks. So let me talk a little bit about what's involved in this code. This is a really fundamental distinction. Those of you, yesterday's or 2 days ago session, we talked about individualism and collectivism as a big difference between cultures. This is probably one of the ways that that plays out more practically. Let's see how well I can manage this today. I did it! So I want to talk about four distinctions between these things, and we'll play with them some more. But one of the analogies I have for high or low context culture is if you're a low context culture, as U.S. Americans tend to be, we're very direct in our verbal style. We tend to reveal our intentions very clearly, and we enunciate things with a forthright tone of voice. If I'm from a high context culture, and I'll say more about the distinction in a minute, verbal statements, instead of clarifying things, are sometimes designed to camouflage my actual intentions in the interest of harmony with the other person. So here's an analogy that works for me. Is if you're part of a low-context culture, low-context, picture yourself buried up to your neck in sand, and that the only means you have to say anything to anybody else is right here up. You know, so you're very low. You're buried in sand, and you're looking around at all the other people buried in sand. How you doing? I'm doing great. Oh, my gallbladder's acting up a little bit. You know, so we tell them everything that's going on about us because that's our only means. High-context cultures, on the other hand, see the whole person, and they see who's there, and what are their relationships to each other, and how do they seem to be with each other, and I'm supposed to be paying attention to all those kinds of codes. For example, we talked about a couple of codes on the first day, those being dermal codes and chemical codes, that we pay attention to things like, is her face a little bit flushed at this moment? Oh, that's hugely important information in a high-context culture. That's a part of the context I'm supposed to be paying attention to, and that if I just talk on as if that was not a message from the other person. I'm an incompetent speaker of that code. So think of low-context communicators like me as people buried up to their necks, and we feel like our means of connecting with other people is here. We do a lot of stuff verbally. High-context culture communicators are paying attention to everything about the person, looking and seeing a lot of what's going on, and really focusing on a more indirect way of looking at things. So, well, let's finish these. And I want to see if you've had some experiences that you would say are examples of crossing from low to high context or high to low context, even just interpersonally. It's not that you had to go to a place where that culture was the norm. Maybe you met somebody who grew up in that kind of culture one time and you find yourself really challenged to have a conversation with them and not really sure what they meant. Here's a second characteristic when you're looking at... Does anybody else have trouble looking at a screen and trying to move things?
No, none of us have that problem.
It's just me. Thanks, Bob. So one other way we vary across these things is that we can have any one of these, any even more than one of these three styles. And again, these are just tendencies in the culture. It doesn't mean everybody in the culture has this style, but that this is another way that communication can vary based on context. A matter-of-fact tone is something European Americans do a lot, and we value people who can do that. We get frustrated, for example, at business meetings where people seem to sort of beat around the bush and just can't say what they mean. Perhaps you notice some of that in the scenario you were just playing out with the other person. An animated conversational style adds emotion to it. You know, African Americans are sometimes seen as very confrontational. It's not confrontation, it's just a characteristic of that particular style of communicating. There's a more animated conversational style. It doesn't mean intimidation. It doesn't mean threat. Interestingly, when you learn a second language, as a sidebar here, you tend to bring along all the paralinguistic stuff from your first language, which is one reason we look at several people from Middle Eastern cultures as being moderately dangerous, because a lot of the Middle Eastern languages have a lot of animation to them. And so a Middle Eastern speaker learns, or an Arabic speaker learns English, and they do English with all these kind of, you know, very animated voice and hands and body. And Scandinavians like me think, oh, scary Arab, scary Arab. And it's only because we take with us all the paralinguistic stuff we had to start with. And we bring it to the second language, and that adds an extra layer of confusion and possible misinterpretation into something.
Yeah, Jeff, when somebody doesn't understand English, and we have a tendency to talk to them in English loud, where does that fit into it? You know,
I want a cheeseburger! That's a kind of incompetence, is all I would say. We're sticking with our original code, and we're saying, you know, I really want you to understand me, and this is my only means of talking to you, so I'm just going to do something I know how to do, which is do it louder, which is generally ineffective except in driving the other person away or making them a little scared. So we have sort of a straightforward style, or we kind of have value-added, this animated style, or we go the other way and have kind of an understated conversational style, displaying more emotional restraint and stoicism. On the first day, I cited my Finnish great-uncle Toivo, and that it was very difficult to tell when Toivo was, in fact, angry or happy, that they all looked about the same. You know, and he felt it just as strongly as anybody else did, but in terms of what the norms were for expressing that, we were kind of mystified by Toivo. I remember after he passed away, my mom was given a poem he'd written on the occasion of meeting Signe, who was his wife of 50-some years, and he met on the adjoining farm, and it was this beautiful poem. And I thought, I had no idea, Toivo, you rascal. I didn't see that at all in him when he was alive, so I was fooled by the style. Here's a third difference. So if you're a speaker in a high-context culture, like using a high-context code, bless you, like Japanese language, a lot of the language really signals to the users what the relative powers are of the people involved. And you aren't negotiating those moment by moment, but that you're reminding each other of the actual authority differences of the people involved, and that's a big part of the style. U.S. Americans, we tend to devalue that sort of thing. We accuse someone of putting on airs if they're trying to present themselves as having a status difference from us. Conversely, maybe you run into Bruce Springsteen on a sidewalk and he stops and has a conversation with you. That's hugely rewarding because the person, you know, had the right to claim that authority but didn't. You know, and whoa, cool! They really get that informal verbal style thing, the importance of upholding informality, role suspension. You know, aside from the fact that we differ greatly in our role, that you could have lunch with the president of Augustana College here, you know, and it's not that you're having dinner with the president, you're having dinner with, you know, Steve. And that we value that in our individualistic society. Whereas many of the high-context cultures are also more collectivistic, and it matters a lot where you are in the hierarchy of that group.
Is the reverse of that work for that person? Is that actually the reverse, where the president of Augustana is having lunch with just little old me kind of thing? Is that opposite?
The same value applies to both. Yeah. Then, yeah. I won't say more because I'll just confuse things. I've had coffee, but not enough. And the last year really is we have different views of silence. In a high context culture, silence says a lot more. It's a lot more important. There's a really interesting study done of Western Apache and their use of silence, and that it's as important, even more important, than understanding the verbal code in that culture. There are actual scenarios where words are inappropriate and silence is absolutely prescribed in those situations. For example, if an Apache child goes away to college and then comes back, they often don't say anything at all, to their parents for as much as a day, because that's a situation that prescribes silence. You have to get to know each other again. You are a different person now than you were when you left. And if you forget that, or if you pretend that doesn't matter, you're an incompetent speaker of that code. So, in many high-context cultures, like the Apache, interpersonal understanding is made possible through silence. It can be the essence of a language of superiority and inferiority. The French example is great, I think. They use silence when there's the absence of an established relationship, which we, you know, U.S. Americans often read as kind of a coldness, disapproval. In Western rhetorical model, prolonged silence is something we want to break. Right? So we call that the ice, and we use talk to break it up. We reserve silence for our most intimate relationships. So silence, it's just important to recognize that we think of silence as something to be gotten rid of or gotten through, generally. In other cultures, silence is something to make space for and to read into, and it's a chance to look around and see what else is happening and be conscious of those things.
the change I've seen in that arena, Jeff, is in the spiritual community, that it seems more and more popular to have these silent retreats, to have small groups where silence is a big part of the journey, on the spiritual journey. So
I've noticed that, too, in my very Western religious upbringing, that a lot of the things that have moved me, help me understand that tradition better, have been things borrowed from more high context cultures, more silence valuing cultures, more slow down, look around kind of cultures. So I feel like I've taken the talk thing about as far as it can take me, and I need to go in this other direction. I wanted to ask, what sorts of experiences now have you had that were similar to what I had you do at the beginning with a partner? Can you describe scenarios where you've been in interaction with somebody where there was clearly another code going on? Or then maybe you've been in the midst of a whole bunch of people who clearly understood what was going on and you didn't. Go ahead, Bruce.
Well, I did.
Bruce, not Doug.
Right. Studied Native American cultures for a few years, and one of the first experiences was there was this big deal one night. This big speaker was. This was on a reservation in South Dakota, and. And the guy just went on and on telling the story of his family and various stories, this and that. And so, and it seemed like he was just rambling to me. And as time went on, I realized that for one thing, their whole thinking about art is tends to be circular as opposed to our linear. But this is a custom with all speakers in that society that the first thing you do is establish who you are before you talk about anything. And it's a very elaborate, ritualized, and it's what when you said that you have learned things from cultures that reminded me of, there's a professor he's an Episcopal and he teaches various kinds of literature, and he said, although I'm I do a lot of things in the Episcopal Church, he said that most of the useful things I've learned in my life I've learned from Native American people. And it seems to me that that's one of those kinds of things, like appreciation of silence, and these rituals are life-giving and honoring.
I find the process you're describing is actually very Christian. Yeah. That when I'm learning about someone else's culture, especially through a code like this one, I start to see my own culture through another set of eyes, and that helps me be more reflective about how I'm impacting other people. Really, intercultural communication is our best alternative to just brute force and violence, you know? And that I have to know a lot about me if I'm going to do that well with you. And I learn a lot about me by being really attentive to you. And I think I have to know your code a little bit to be appropriately attentive to you. It feels like this whole chain of things that's very productive and very very good for Christian community, I think, in the world. So that's a great point. Go ahead, sir.
And a year ago, when I took a studentship to Europe, I took a class, and they were explaining to us, in the United States, when you go to a cocktail party to meet people, you try to find out what you have in common. They said, in Europe, you will find the opposite. They want to find out how you are different. And it's a whole cultural difference, and you can misinterpret it in terms of they want to pick a fight or something. So it's really their way.
Was that your experience also when you were there?
Oh, yes, very definitely.
How did it feel?
Well,
did it help to have been prepared for it, I guess, is what I mean.
Yes, it did, and I could appreciate. I found it interesting once I said, this is okay, this is what we're doing. It made it much more interesting than just finding what we had in common.
Great. Are there examples of things you've experienced that are like this? Shannon? Aaron? Her name, I don't know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was in Tanzania at a girls' school. And it was like an end-of-the-year presentation kind of experience. And it turned out that they did introductions, and all of the women, it was an all-women's school, but all of the women spoke so softly when they introduced themselves, you couldn't hear. And I'm positive it wasn't because I had bad hearing, but that was the way it worked, and everyone was okay with it. I'm like, why don't you introduce yourself? You can't hear it. You know, that was across the board. They all spoke so softly that no one could hear
it. So it was clearly a shared code that you weren't a part of.
Oh, clearly.
But
and
you
were all okay with it.
You weren't saying, hey, speak up!
No, I chose not to.
Okay. Aaron?
Interestingly enough, I think one of my most radical cultural experiences in that regard was this spring when I was an intern at the Washington State Legislature. I would put on a suit jacket and a tie, and once I stepped into, you know, the marble halls, you're in a different world there. I mean, you're swimming in low-context communicators. And every time, you know, if you're walking in the same direction as someone to a hearing or something, they'll feel the need to shake your hand and talk to you the whole way. It's like this agreement that you talk to everybody, and everybody has the appearance of knowing one another, but it's all very fake. I mean, people talk to me as if they had known me forever, and I'm not sure if they realize they didn't. And so it was very kind of weird to me, because you were expected to instantly strike a conversation and find something.
So if we think in terms of the cultural iceberg of legislative culture, that second level where we talk about norms and rituals and things, that this was a ritual. This is a ritualized kind of hallway talk that you're supposed to do, even though it feels false to you coming from another culture.
Oh, yeah.
You know that to be a competent player in this culture, I have to play along.
Well, you have to appear strong and on the ball and everything, too. It's
great.
Weird.
Great example. Marilyn, last one.
Well, last night I sat in on the writing class, and we were read four poems, and the poems were advice from my grandmother, from different cultures, New York Jewish grandmother, Cuban grandmother, and I don't know, remember the other two. Mm-hmm. And then we were asked to write about advice from our own grandparents. Mm-hmm. Well, your example of your Uncle Toivo, mm-hmm. I was stymied because I had Swedish grandparents. My grandfather came from Sweden, Norwegian on the other side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They didn't give me any advice. And I said, what am I going to write? But then, just as you said, I remember when my grandfather was very old. Once I came home from college and he hugged me and he said, you know, I really do have deep feelings. And it's a...
That was a costly statement.
Yeah. So, but then I've also had the experience of studying with a really well-known painter, William Tebow, at UC Davis. And having the experience of having lunch with him and him being interested in everything that I wanted to eat and who I was, which is very different from my husband, who is very busy all the time. You know, he's a classic low, whatever you call the LCC guys. So I'm constantly going from one culture to another and having to adjust.
Great. You, Bruce, your scenario talked about something that I happen to have a resource for, so I wanted to share it here, too. When we're thinking about doing persuasion or doing even like small group work across cultures, that one of the ways high and low context cultures really differ is whether we do things in a linear way or sort of a spiral way. And if you're used to linear conversation and you get stuck in a spiral, you can feel like you're not getting anywhere. But that there are a couple different kinds of linear styles, one that relies on the importance of facts, evidence, eyewitness accounts, testimonials, proofs. You watch your local news, you see this style played out, you know, perfectly and trying to understand some stabbing that took place that day. Axiomatic deductive form that you sort of set out a syllogism and then you fill in the blanks, you know, like, well, all people of this sort are this way, and then you start to fill in the blanks. That's characteristic of, say, a Russian culture doing that. But those are both forms of linear persuasion. Many, many cultures in the world don't do either of these. They do something that's more spiral, ranging from the dramatic. Arab, Italian, Jewish cultures, for example, using a lot of metaphors, stories, flowery adjectives, the kinds of things that just would totally annoy my father in a meeting. You know, get to the point. Dramatic style, or a more subtle style, of resorting to hints, implicit analogies, end sayings, koans, subtle nonverbal gestures, that you're supposed to notice those kinds of things, and that you keep talking around issues that it seems like maybe you've dealt with already, but you keep coming back around again and again and again to those kinds of cultures. Go ahead.
I grew up in Flagstaff, and there's a huge Native American population up there because we've got the reservation right next to us. And it used to, I mean, it took a really long time to get used to. I'd ask, you know, one of the Native American students at my first year of high school for directions. They wouldn't say anything. They'd glance that way. And that was their way of telling me that's where I'm supposed to go. But it took a really long time for me to, like, pick up on that and say, oh, okay, well, you did just give me directions. You're not completely ignoring me.
It's just your code, actually. I remember being in a rock band in college and playing a gig on a reservation in northern Minnesota, playing at a Native American high school. I think we played their prom or something. And nobody danced. nobody applauded, and everybody afterwards said what a good time they had. It was just, we went home to shit. It was
Jeff, it's interesting because the first one you put up there,
yeah,
we spend thousands and thousands of dollars trying to teach people sales skills, which all actually are associated with item A, 1A.
Right. And maybe that is effective, you know, the cultures that are.
Yeah, and then you have to relearn because it's a different set of skills if you're going to go to China or somewhere else to.
European cocktail party person?
To bring it home, I was talking to a young fellow in his early 20s who was going to a Lutheran church because his girlfriend wanted to go. And I asked him, how did you experience the service? And he said, well, I didn't find anything I could connect to in the service.
Really?
I did enjoy talking to the old folks at coffee time because that was rich.
All the stories.
Yep.
What church was that? Because we can't get anybody to talk at coffee time, except unless you know somebody.
Here's another difference between the two is high context cultures tend to be more self-humbling also, that your individual self gets to play less of a role. It's the nail that sticks up that gets pounded back down again. So self-humbling verbal mode is a way to do that for yourself instead of making other people do it for you, put you in your place, so to speak. So modest talk, verbal restraints, hesitations, self-deprecation, including one's effort and performance. You hear some of this in dominant U.S. culture, too, but sometimes it feels false. You read the sports page, for example. And, oh, Peter, that was you did great hitting today. Oh, well, it was just my lucky day. You know, they gave me a couple good pitches to hit, and I hit him, and I couldn't do it without my teammates and all this stuff. But inside, you feel like the athlete's going, yeah, I rock. Yeah. And that's self-credentialing, is that you tend to, in high-context or low-context cultures, we remind people of our credentials. We say them because they don't see them. We're buried up to our necks in sand. So part of our talk is designed to make sure people know that we're worth listening to. Whereas in a high-context culture, you're supposed to pay attention to everybody that who's there. You know who's worth listening to and talking to. I wanted to get to the idea that Dennis introduced by coming in the door and then leaving again. Is this notion of face, which is, it's important in all cultures, but it's especially important in some, in the high-context cultures. We're not as attentive to it in U.S.-American cultures as we could be. But it's a social construct. If you look at number one there, I am offering to you right now, and so are you, how I would like to be seen by you. It's something that's hidden in all of our communication. Jim, would you say hi to me?
Hello.
Hello. Okay, here it is. I caught it. Think of it like an icon on the screen. You can click on it, and there's this whole menu of stuff that appears there. I said, say hi to me. She didn't say hi. What did you say? You said hello. So a little more formal term. Did she say it right away? I said, say hi to me. She didn't go, hi. She thought about it for a couple seconds, and then she said hello, and she said it with a smile and holding eye contact. All those things mean something. They were choices on her part, right? So, and you did this in part because you want to be seen as a certain sort of person, and so do I. It's an unavoidable part of our communication with each other, that when I'm negotiating with you is my identity. It's not something I get to carry around privately like a backpack. According to this perspective, we are always negotiating our identity with other people. And that we can only have our identity affirmed by other people, which strikes me as a devoutly Christian concept when you think about it, or you know, many faith traditions, that we become who we are in the midst of other people. How am I treated? Who do I offer? And which of those do you affirm? Which of those things about me do you challenge? Think about when you were a student in college, or you are a student in college, how do you challenge a professor who's boring, and yet you're wary of the power difference?
Don't show up.
Don't show up. That's just one. Other strategies?
I asked a lot of questions. If I thought they were boring, I thought, I'll ask questions about things I'm interested in. Get him on that track. Keep him going on. And then I get what I need out of it.
Okay, so that's an...
He still gets to talk.
That's a face-appropriate way to sort of assert some control in the situation. Right? It is? Some people look at their watches. Not that any of this ever happens in my class. It's not personal experience at all, of course. But you know, we have all these subtle strategies that help us maintain our face as, you know, I'm a good, smart student, an interesting person. You know, you're not living up to quite my standards here. I'm going to disaffirm some of your expressed identity that you'd like to have here. I'm going to not affirm that necessarily. And I do this, and we're very clever about how we do this with each other all the time. So it's this claim sense of social self-worth, and I can only have it affirmed by other people. And for our purposes, you can look at face a couple different ways, but this is a really interesting way to look at face, that we have both self-face concerns and other face concerns in every situation. And that if you're competent, if you're a really good communicator, both intraculturally and interculturally, you're capable of negotiating both so that nobody has to lose face. Some of those situations are really challenging. For example, if I do something wrong in class, Janet, maybe I wrong you in class, I have to come up with a way to apologize to you that helps save face for you, but also doesn't damage my face too much. I have to still present those kinds of things. And it's really challenging. There are a couple different kinds of face needs that are thought to be universal. One is that we all have a need to be included and affirmed. I want you to treat me as if I'm smart and worthwhile and worth including. So, you know, if you're dismissive of me, oh, I hate that. You know, if you shun me in the midst of a group, for example, that's not just here, that is here. That's harsh. On the other hand, we also want to be left alone. We want to be given a degree of freedom and autonomy. We don't want to give off the appearance of being told what to do. That's especially true for those of us raised in a relatively masculine way. In this culture, we refer to them as men. we very much resist the notion of being told what to do. For example, remember the term politically correct and why that term was coined? There was a movement that said, you know, here's some real right, I would even say Christian ways of speaking with other people and ways of treating other people and being sensitive to other people's faces. You really should talk like this. A significant percentage of people in U.S. American culture thought to themselves, I was doing that already. Didn't you notice? Well, you can't make me do that. That's just political correctness. I don't do anything that's politically correct. I am my own person. So, some, you know, it can really backfire. So you've got these two kind of contrasting needs. I want to be valued and included, and I want you to leave me alone. I want both of those things. I want to be included, I want to be left alone. You know, that's a real challenge. So in our interactions with people from other cultures, we're always balancing how much attention am I going to give to protecting my own face, which is our temptation in individualistic cultures. We spend a lot of time thinking about self-enhancement. I'm paying attention to my own face more than I'm paying attention to the other face. Whereas a collectivistic, high-context culture pays a lot of attention to the faces of everybody there. Harmony is a big issue. So we have these kinds of face concerns. For those of you who weren't here, Dennis gave us just a great impromptu example. He came partway in just after we'd started, stopped, saw me, realized this wasn't the session he wanted to do, stood there in the doorway for a couple of seconds, and then said, oh, I wanted to go to at least one of everybody's sessions, and I hadn't been to one of, I think it's Peter's sessions that's going on opposite this one. And so we smiled at each other, and out he went. But he had to come up with a scenario that saved face for himself, because he opened the door, and everybody turned to look, and then he was stuck. You know, there he was. And he also wanted to come up with something that didn't cause you or me or anyone else to sort of feel somehow shamed by him appearing here. And it took him just a couple seconds. I mean, we're great face machines, aren't we? I mean, we really can think of this stuff. He had a whole menu of choices for anything from, oh, man, you're awful. I don't want to stay here. Oh, I can't believe I came in here. You know, and off he goes. Or he could have just said nothing and, you know, cost himself a lot of face, or, you know, left feeling, you know, totally embarrassed and sweaty that he couldn't come up with anything good to say. And he, in fact, trod the middle road of competent communication and came up with a good narrative that sort of saved it for us. So, especially in high-context cultures, face is a lot more prominent than it is in our low-context cultures, although you'd be surprised how important it is here. My line of research, by the way, is studying face in instruction, in teaching, and that I can show you evidence about the kinds of motivations that are nurtured in students who receive competent face work versus those who don't. And that's another term here. The actual communicative act is face work. When you think about not just the notion of face, but what are we actually doing? Face work is the specific verbal and nonverbal behaviors or actions that we do to both prevent or restore face loss. If I can anticipate, oh, this is going to be a tough one, I got to be careful. You know, you use face work kind of anticipating things that are going to be tough, and you catch them like Dennis did. Or things that happen that are face-threatening. Somebody might say something to another person in the dinner line, and the person's clearly offended somehow, then you have to do some repair. But that we our term for that is that you're doing face work. So I lose face when I'm treated in a way that challenges or ignores who I say I am. Okay, I present myself as a knowledgeable person about this stuff, and you might raise your hand and really challenge me on that, or do some kind of nonverbal things that, you know, let me think you think I'm full of hooey. And that would be a face-threatening, you know, I'd suffer some face-loss situation. And that we're always presented with face issues, especially when you're trying to request something. Because any kind of request is a redirection of what the person was already doing. Okay? If I wanted you to open the door, for example, what are you doing right now? You're not opening the door, right? You're sitting comfortably. Yeah. So when I say, would you please open the door? And, oh, geez, all right, I'll open the door. I'm not really asking you to open the door. But we have a whole range of strategies we can use, from very direct, open the door! You know, that kind of stuff. Or to, you know, wow, it's really warm in here. You know, and that's how we deal with face, is by a matter of directness or indirectness, which, as you remember, is one of the differences between those cultures. Go ahead, Peter.
Email.
Say more, please, Mr. Engineer.
Email, face, and email, and you get into such big trouble with email and what you say, because you have no context other than words. Yeah. And I just feel like there's been a lot of damage to face on both directions. Unsophisticated in how we can use it or do use it. It's, you know, I had to pull myself out of a little sticky situation the week before we left on this trip because of email.
Could you pull yourself out via email, or did you have to rely on a richer context?
I set up a lunch meeting, and so we went and had lunch and talked about lots of contexts that had virtually nothing to do with what the email dust-up was.
But did it help?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it helped immensely, but I just find that email has been incredibly frustrating for that, because people read so much into it, and they don't have any tone inflection, they don't have facial expressions, they don't have hand gestures, they have virtually no context at all except words on a page, and people, especially, you know, well, I shouldn't generalize at all, but I will. I think
I shouldn't generalize at all, but I will.
I mean, I'm just guessing that a lot of it has to do with self-esteem and how much you read into it. If you've got a lot of self-esteem, you'll probably just blow right past certain things, but if you've got low self-esteem, you're going to be reading through the lines and take everything as being very offensive and personal and directed at you too. And so I find that without, you know, when you're using email to communicate with people that you don't know and you've never met before, it's just extremely tricky to deal with. Mm-hmm. And I think I've wasted a lot of time thinking about that and having to clean up after myself with email.
Not alone, though. I mean, you're right that it's a very restricted code. It's become prominent for so many of us, and yet we lack the same vocabulary we have even on the telephone or certainly face-to-face, and we don't know how to convey those same kinds of subtleties through just text on the screen.
I have a pen with stuff in red.
Does that help?
Well, it lets me know that he doesn't agree with me.
Okay, so red color signifies something.
We strongly, in business, we're struggling to try to almost take the computer away from our salespeople. We want you to go back to a face-to-face encounter with that person. Because there's no dialogue. You don't know what this person's thinking. You don't know what the situation he's in, when he receives that. It just goes on and on and on, and we're losing business. Where you think that was going to enhance business. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a double-edged sword. It's interesting, because you do get yourself, you know, you get confrontation.
Last comment on this?
I was going to say, yet I have teenage kids, and they're much more sophisticated at expressing themselves over the email. And so I don't know if there's something we can learn from them, or they're just in a different culture, or, you know.
People who do IM a lot, instant messaging, have a lot more shorthand that conveys more of that emotional context. I wanted to share some more information today about some particular things that we know about face work and how it shows up for us here. We have about 10 minutes left. I know, is that funny? But really, all we're doing here is raising questions that then we get to talk about for the next week and a half. It's just fun. Asian-American conflict styles are really influenced by a Confucian philosophy. So you're looking more long-term. You're looking at the status notions of relationships and collective face-saving. It's important to save face for everybody who's involved. So they tend to use avoiding or obliging. They may be saying yes, when in fact they aren't in agreement with you. It's just a way to safely navigate that situation to maintain harmony in that situation. Sometimes use a third party as a way of saving face for people, but face is huge within many, not all, many Asian American cultures. The second one, looking at Latino and Latina American conflict styles, it's important to be tactful, to be careful. Native American. And again, these are generalizations. You know, as Americans, we're tempted. You see a generalization, you start looking for exceptions, and that's great. That makes you more rather than less competent, is to recognize that, okay, here's the tendency I could probably look for, but it's not, that doesn't mean, oh, you belong to that group, well, I know all about you. Well, I have a good starting point for you, and I'm willing to watch it be incorrect. Verbal restraint, self-discipline, more other and mutual face sensitive rather than self-face sensitive in disputes, that it becomes very important to take care of the other people there. And again, asking a third party often is done. Caucasian American. Sometimes, you know, when people are in conflict, that their voices really go down. They really start being intense in conversation. That's something, that's one way I know my dad's mad, and we have to stop talking politics yet again. As he becomes very non-verbally and emotionally restrained rather than emotive, he starts to rein those things in. I get the sense of a locomotive being stoked and really getting focused on the argument. And we're influenced primarily by individualistic values. And lastly here, rather than low-keyed, African-American conflict styles are often pretty high-keyed, energetic, animated, emotionally expressive. We Anglos are often tempted to interpret that as dangerous. You know, oh, I'm about to get hit. Because if my Uncle Toybo was doing that, oh my goodness, he's probably on the verge of, you know, a heart attack. He's getting energetic, animated, and emotionally expressive. And we prefer, or this group prefers a more emotionally engaged, assertive discussion mode. I heard a dude.
Jeff, do we know anything about Pacific Island?
We may, but I don't in particular. Often they're lumped together with the Asian concern, so it might be a good way to start. What's the other one? Here it is. It's the last bit of, this is some kind of prescriptive advice. You have to know that my biggest challenge in being here is trying to rein myself in from sharing too much stuff and not giving you enough time to talk and think. I'd like to allow a little bit of time for that today. But here's some things to really take out of today, I think. When you're looking at the difference between high and low context ways of looking at the world, those codes, one of the things is to recognize that those differences are real and that they are codes. I like that metaphor. That works. That there's a high context code. There's a low context code. If you were raised with one, you don't necessarily interpret the other one correctly. You interpret it in light of your own code. And so the trick is to try and interpret their code in light of their code, so that you understand more of what they intend. Again, if you're from an individualistic culture, we tend to use more direct, low-context communication than people who are from high-context cultures. Those two things often go together. Individualism, low-context, collectivism, high-context. Not always. That's why they're different concepts. But you can make a reliable guess about which code you're likely facing. Again, individualists tend towards self-face, collectivists tend toward other-face. Okay, if I'm an individualist, I'm careful about making sure I don't come out looking bad. If I'm a collectivist, I'm more concerned that other people don't come out looking poorly. I would even sacrifice some of my own face to make sure that didn't happen. If I use low-context communication, I like a direct verbal style, matter-of-fact mode, self-credentialing enhancer. Talkativeness. I'm high context, more indirect, understated emotionality, self-humbling, self-effacing, silence. Silence helps me gauge the situation, right? That's why silence is productive. I'm not sort of talking my way through it and paying attention. I'm shutting up and paying attention to what's going on. And one interesting sidelight here, and you were asking about this yesterday, there are some gender differences. If you were raised pretty traditionally masculine in the country, we tend to be more low context. It's an important part of masculine identity that you can assert and be clear, and an important part of female identity, feminine identity, that you be more attentive to other people and to relationship, part of the socialization that happens. You have to know both verbal and nonverbal communication if you're going to be sensitive across these boundaries. It's not enough just to know the language. It's not enough just to know the nonverbal norms. It really helps to know both. The last sentence here is the one that matters. The rest looks like jargon to me. If you have a genuine inquiring attitude, you're going to find out more than if you have kind of a monologuing, let me tell you about me attitude, which is one of the reasons if competition is at the core and self-aggrandizement is near the core of U.S. American culture, it makes it difficult for us to do this inquiring attitude because it has more to do with inhaling than exhaling. And we're
better at exhaling. I mean, listen to me. I've been exhaling at you for most of an hour, and you seem okay with that. You know, that this is more the norm for us. Not a lot of silence. What? What just happened?
Nothing.
Someone just touched me.
That's me.
You know, I do have one other thing to share with you.
By looking at that, why don't we listen as a form of communication?
We do.
Why don't we talk more about, we focus more on the verbal, the listening is official verbal.
Yeah, we get lots of courses in English and using the verbal code. We don't get courses in nonverbal communication necessarily. We don't get courses in listening, where our culture really reinforces. The important thing to learn is how to use the linguistic code. Let's see if I have time for this. I don't.
It's very interesting that one of the simple exercises that a trainer named Eric Law uses is called mutual invitation. Mm-hmm. So that instead of simply asking for people to respond to something, people invite one another. And it completely changes the dynamic because we don't have the luxury of just thinking about what we're going to say. We're structured to listen better. And it absolutely can change council meetings, Bible studies, and it's a way of affirming introvert behavior and controlling extroverts, which
great
is
example.
Not always easy to do.
I'm shocked in arguments with my Emily when she will stop and say, okay, so what I hear you saying is, and she'll stop and try and understand what it is that I'm trying to express and take time to really solicit from me and make sure she's got it right. And sometimes it always changes the argument, but sometimes it just finishes the argument in a really productive way. That, oh, you're asking, you're inhaling, you're not just doing some more at me here. And it spurs me to do the same. That reciprocity norm in our culture is really strong. You know, if somebody does that with me, then I end up doing it with them. Last comment today.
Last comment?
Yep, that'd be good.
Better be good.
Yep.
I've noticed in churches, when you study the worship of churches, I mean, there are places in the liturgy that are programmed for silence. You know, meditative silence after the sermon, the silence between the statement, let us pray. There should be a collective silence there. There are several points in the liturgy where there is supposed to be silence, you know, that speaks louder than words. And invariably, every time I visit a church, you know, the liturgist runs over those points of silence that are supposed to be there and then inserts meaningless acts of silence as a result of someone's poor planning or an error or something like that. So silence is a very powerful medium in liturgy that is widely around.
Right. And that's certainly not the person's intention, I'm sure. It's just an incompetent use of silence to do that kind of thing. Even when it says in the program, silence for reflection, self-reflection and meditation, we get about 10 seconds of it. We get it in the classroom as well when you say, teachers say, any questions? Okay. Thank you for coming today.
Could I have a quick PS?
All right, he's adding a quick PS.
Last Sunday in the text, there was a real gem. John the Baptist was talking to Herod about how he was sinning by marrying his brother's wife. And then it says, and Herod wanted to listen to him. Mm-hmm. And so read that and have a discussion about how could you talk to someone about negative feedback and help them to want to listen.
Exactly. One of the biggest challenges faced by teachers, for example, is how do you get your students to keep learning from you? Thank you for coming today.